it was thanks to Renee that our production, our wonderful production assistant, Mike Linton, got to see Sleeping Demons and got to persuade John Patrick Shanley to join us on the Soleri Report. And so I want to just briefly again introduce him. He interviewed with us from New York. He is a unbelievably this is a man who's written many, many wonderful plays, many including doing the scripts for many movies, including one of my favorite Alive, Moonstruck, many. It is extraordinary when you, and I've had the opportunity to read Sleeping Demons, the ability of the artist to go inside the complexity of one defaulted mortgage and one possible foreclosure, and the politics of the household, the politics of the community, and the politics of the government in the local area, and really break down the complexity of all the issues of how we got ourselves into this mess. So we're going to play the interview for you now with John Patrick Shanley.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us on the Soleri Report. You are the first playwright. We normally cover economic topics, and our wonderful production assistant, Michael Linton, had the opportunity to see your play, Sleeping Demon, which is absolutely extraordinary. You were kind enough to make a copy available to me, and I've read it, and it's just it's remarkable. I mean, it's just really remarkable, and it's part of a series called Church and State, which is started with your, I think, one of your most famous, which is both a play and a movie, Doubt. So
yes.
Maybe if we could begin, you could tell us how you came to write Church and State and the evolution of it.
Absolutely. Well, I guess, you know, I was raised in the Catholic school system as a kid and was educated by the Sisters of Charity, who were an order of nuns who wore these sort of peculiar black bonnets that you didn't see generally when you saw depictions of nuns. And later in life, I thought, just on the most simplistic level, I should do a play sometime about those nuns because nobody's ever seen those outfits, except the few of us who were educated by them. But over time, I realized that it was a great backdrop for some of the larger questions that I have in my life, and the biggest one probably being the fact that I function from a place where I know that I don't know anything, and yet I want to be an effective member of the community. So I want to act with a kind of certainty and assertiveness to be an effective member of life, and at the same time acknowledge that I cannot truly know anything for certain. So how do I get those two things to work together? Doubt sort of came out of that, together with childhood experiences that I had, where I had teachers who I saw were molesting others, not in the Catholic Church, by the way. These are lay teachers. And yet were not molesting me, were actually great educators of mine. And how could I reconcile those things? Which I think in some level is something that every kid, adolescent, and probably adult goes through, that people are a mixed bag. And parts of them can be quite dark and destructive towards some, even if it's not towards you. And how do you take the good and leave the rest? Or should you? And then in the society around me, I saw that American society, that there was an ongoing conflict, attempt to resolve the distinctions between church and state, where one began, where the other ended, and if they did, and where morality and spirituality fit into public life.
Well, I've spent a lot of my life sort of grappling with corruption, how you stop it, how you clean it up, more on the financial side. And the thing that's, I haven't seen Defiance, which is the second one, but what weaves through Doubt and through the Sleeping Demon is sort of grappling with this corruption, both of systems and people, at a very intimate level, and how murky it gets. you know, and you feel that incredible struggle. I know in Sleeping Demon you really feel it.
Well, this character in Sleeping Demon, who's a minor political figure in New York, he's the Bronx Borough President, and it's not any real Bronx Borough President, but one in my imagination. And he had the history that when he was a kid, he was half Latino and half Italian, that he was raised by a father who had a little storefront church. And was a Pentecostal, that he admired his father greatly, and wanted to become a preacher just like his father had been. But then at a certain point, he saw his mother crying, sitting at the kitchen table, and asked her why, and she said that she'd had to support all of these children and her husband, and that she was fighting diabetes, and that she was exhausted, and didn't know if she could continue to go on in the vein that she had. And he, at that moment, chose to help people in this world, with this world, the material world, and decided to become a politician. But that conflict between his mother's influence and his father's influence had remained a real, if dormant, in him until he comes into a conversation with a guy who started a storefront church and isn't paying his rent. And as a result of that, the woman who owns the building, a little two-story building, is going to lose her home. This brings out the latent rage that this politician has at his father for being irresponsible to the material concerns of this world. And so he sort of enters into a prolonged struggle, ideological struggle, with this preacher over what is moral and correct in this world that we live in, and in whatever way that it overlaps with any other worlds that might exist.
One of the reasons that Mike so wanted me to read Sleeping Demon, do you know the expression fraudulent inducement?
I'm not sure that I do.
Okay, it's a legal term. When I if I'm a bank or a financial institution, and I make you a loan, and I know something about your circumstance or the future that you don't, if I have reason to believe you won't be able to pay it back, and I don't tell you about that, I don't share that information,
yes,
that loan could be deemed to be fraudulently induced, and you may not be liable for all or some of it. And
right.
One of the reasons Mike wanted me to know about you and your work was, one of the things I was very concerned about in the 90s, as I kept saying, the banks are fraudulently inducing these mortgage loans. And,
right.
You know, a lot of these mortgages may not be legal because they're loaning to people when they know, in fact, incomes are going to fall, and the people who are borrowing don't realize. And one of
right.
the things
and even
you
if
do...
The, many of those people did not, you know, even if their incomes didn't fall, they couldn't afford those loans.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of loans given
that's
out under
yeah.
under the most blatantly, you know, that the math just didn't work.
And one of the things you get into, the woman who has borrowed the loan, she's got two loans, she's got a mortgage and she's got a set. Well, that's one of the things that impresses me. You get all this in somehow without getting overly complex. But she's got a mortgage and she took a second to finance the, you know, the tenant in the storefront church, and she, her husband is a CPA who's now sick, and it's interesting because, you know, the problems, a lot of the default problems on the mortgages come not just from falling incomes, but from health problems. And so the husband, Max, we open up with Max meeting with a banker and going through all of these different issues of the morality of sort of how the mortgage game is working, both on the morality of the banks and what they're up to and the morality of the people borrowing and what they're up to. And
yes,
walk
well, I mean, it certainly has seemed as if morality didn't enter into it on the bank side of the equation.
Right, right. But all the different issues of what in the world is going on here and why are we behaving this way, and how did we get into this mess in the first place? you know, sort of come out as a part of the context, because of course the main story is the individual people and them struggling with consciousness. I just have to read one part because I'm used to plays building up to a powerful point, and literally right at the beginning, bam, you had me. Literally, I was laughing so hard I was crying. I want to read this. This is Max when he's meeting with a banker. He says, "This country was built by giants. They died and midgets moved in. Tiny people were walking around inside this republic like a 9-year-old boy wearing his father's suit. When the tiny people got in power, they changed what was taught in school. No great books, no big people. Everybody's tiny now." I couldn't believe it. It was so powerful. I was blown away. And then he says, "Greatness is real and giants come along. You might be one. The opportunity is there right now."
There you go.
It's very hopeful because it reminds us, you know, we are in a time where we're all being tiny, but we don't have to be.
Well, there does seem to be at this time a worldwide leadership vacuum that from time to time, visionaries come along and reorganize society based on an idea that is so powerful that it cannot be denied. And it organizes and unifies societies to go boldly in a single strong direction for a period of time. Certainly the United States of America was such a phenomenon because intellectual brain trust and moral brain trust formed this republic in a way that was deeply impressive to the entire, certainly, Western world. And over time, I would say that at this time, you know, that brain trust, which in that period was put to the purpose of the betterment of all of society, in our time, the best minds have been put to work to how to better themselves. And to the detriment of society, and also, in effect, over time, to their own detriment, because it was basically, you know, short-term profits over long-term viability that was going on in this latest economic crisis. There was no way that the financial model that was being used just prior to the mortgage crisis could hold. So it was, simply a case of do what makes today feel good, even knowing that you are destroying the near future's possibility of remaining a positively functioning economic model.
So one of the things that happens with Sleeping Demon is the borough president is then squeezed by the top executive at the bank.
Yeah.
And we get him sort of in this conundrum of is he going to do the right thing for the people, or is he going to get squeezed by this bank president? And the issues are not all black and white. It's
right.
Kind of gray. Yeah, and it's
as they usually are, you know.
Yeah, it's very painful. You know, you're squirming as you live through it, and I don't quite know how you manage to do that. I'm tempted to ask you how you know so well what it's like to get squeezed.
Oh, I think every adult knows how what it's like to get squeezed. But you know, basically, when I write, I'm inviting you into the house that I live in. And by that I mean I have a point of view, and I see the pluses and minuses and the moral constraints and hedonistic impulses within myself, and they inform my responses to the things around me. And I basically want you to understand how I see things and how I experience complex questions, because, you know, it can be as simple as buying Apple stock and having to face the fact that some of the factories in China are, you know, not honoring quality of life among human beings? And how do you reconcile those things? Do you reconcile those things? Do you buy a tobacco stock? Do you buy an oil stock? And certainly, like with the question of oil, you know, whether or not you should own an oil stock is extremely complicated, because certainly oil is
right.
used to many beneficial purposes. Tobacco,
right.
maybe not so much.
Well, but what I found in America, we're always easy, you know, it's easy to say they did this, it's wrong. To get people
mm-hmm.
to look at how my money is working, you know,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's the in Sleeping Demon, it's the pastor who encouraged the money to be borrowed, or the woman who borrowed the money, or the bank who made a loan they shouldn't. You're
mm-hmm.
walking people through, you know, our failure to take responsibility and all the different roles involved at a very intimate level. And in our society, this is the one thing that we don't want to look at. We don't want to look at the intimacy, you know, or our complicity, or how it works, you know, in our money and our lives. You know, we don't want to look at me and see what I can do to deal with me. And
well,
yet,
that,
not only are you doing that, but people love to watch the, you know, these are wonderful, successful plays and movies. They get people to enjoy
sometimes,
doing that.
Sometimes.
That's what got me stuck.
Well, I mean, you know, we are not perfect beings, nor are we supposed to be. There is absolutely no way that you're going to live your life without causing harm to other people on some level, even just by breathing. And you must make peace with that if you are going to enjoy your life. And I think that that is important. I think that you are supposed to enjoy your life. I think you should do your best to do that. And that was certainly one of the precepts of the founding fathers, the pursuit of happiness, but not at the ruthless and excessive expense of others. But there are going to be expenses incurred in others if you are to live and to have a life that is not completely informed by guilt. And I very much believe that you should do that, you should embrace it, and that it's a matter of balancing these things, and also your own individual conscience and consciousness. So, you know, the title of the play, Sleeping Demon, refers to something that the preacher says of the borough president. When the borough president says that he has a social conscience, he says, do not wake that sleeping demon. That killed Martin Luther King, it killed Socrates, and it will kill you. It is to live a life totally of conscience. Is in a way a form of severity that I think is not truly embracing of humanity. And so you've got to be careful on that front too. I do, for instance, occasionally smoke a cigar. I don't own tobacco stocks, but I'm glad that I can get that cigar.
Right. Well, you bring all the characters, I don't want to give away the whole story, but you bring all the characters in to the storefront church. And, you know, here's a group of people who've been in the business of sort of helping each other fail. And they get in the church and they start getting in the business of helping each other face the truth and be redeemed somehow. It's very New York, because it's very organic and very human. And it's wonderful. And part of it is this dance between the material world and the spiritual world, and how to have integrity and, you know, in both.
When they get into that church, which is a kind of arbitrary church, you know, it's a storefront church, so it's a mixed-use two-story building, and the ground floor, which, you know, was a laundromat before, this guy has taken and put, you know, some folding chairs in there and an electric piano. He said it's a church, and he sort of sets about inventing a religion. As opposed to adhering to some organized religion with a definite set of precepts, he wants to say something in his sermon that he actually currently believes and feels connected to. And what he's really doing is he is finding a community. he is refinding the sort of basic building block of society, which is the local community. And I think that one of the problems that we've been having in our society is that the community has been damaged. And part of that has been just simply all of us in our homes on the internet becoming more and more separated from each other and forgetting the great communal power that is available to us, which in times gone by has very often taken place in churches and in the halls of government. And in the sort of sense of like the Greeks did it, you know, where the whole community or a significant part of the community became involved in the political process to the purpose of the betterment of all the people or a great number of the people. And that there's been an isolating thing that's been going on in this country where government has become increasingly insulated from the individual and individuals become increasingly insulated from each other, so that a feeling of helplessness and cynicism is pervading many, many people's individual experience of life.
It comes in a couple of ways. You get the feeling the preachers from New Orleans and has been traumatized by Katrina and the events around that. But the most beautiful one is amazing. You have the banker having a gingerbread house, and as they're having the conversation, they slowly break the house down and eat it.
Yes.
It's the most amazing kind of metaphor image. This is, you know, as the lies fly back and forth.
Well, and also the gingerbread house was a present for his son, so he's eating his own son's house.
But financially, that's what's going on. You know, that's
absolutely,
it's just remarkable. Yeah. I wanted to mention one of the things I promised Mike I would tell you about is I served as Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration, and I got there, and every day I started to get this increased feeling of sort of free-floating anxiety. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And it kept getting worse and worse and worse. And finally I realized everyone was coming to lobby me to do something that would make their stock go up. But nobody was lobbying me to improve the health of places, because the financial system was kind of organized on an industry basis, and so places weren't traded in the stock market, and so nobody made money from a place being successful. And so I ended up coining a term called the Popsicle Index, and I wanted to describe it to you. The Popsicle Index is the percent of people in a place who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. So let me say it again. It's the percent of people in a place who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. It's a guy in England who used to call it room to roam. And part of the sort of shrinking from the giants to the tiny is the room to roam for most children is shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And we've now reached a point where, you know, parents don't want their kids to go anywhere unless they have an adult supervision. But one of the things I used to do for years, so I used to say what I came to as Assistant Secretary of Housing is everybody was lobbying me to get the Dow Jones to go up, but nobody was lobbying me to get the Popsicle Index to go up. So how do we rebuild the balance between the Popsicle Index and the Dow? And I did a couple workshops with in communities where I'd ask people what they thought the Popsicle Index was. And the power of the Popsicle Index was not that it was particularly accurate, but that everybody controlled it. In other words, my Popsicle Index is whatever I feel it is. And so what it did was it inspired these wild conversations between kids and their parents and different generations about how they felt about whether they were safe in their place. And what came out was this dichotomy that you talk about between the spiritual and the material, or the energetic and the material. And the people needed a way of expressing that energetic or spiritual need in the context of their community, and it was getting eaten alive and they felt completely stymied. And that's what is so powerful about what you bring out, is this struggle to rebuild that. Does that make
any
sense?
Well, it's there. You know, right after 9/11 in New York, the streets filled up with people having a natural communal desire to help. It was put to no purpose. There was no way they could find, for the most part, have this very, very natural and powerful and positive impulse. There was no social mechanism for them to become involved. And it's the thing that people in this country are starving for, because there is an altruistic impulse in people that needs to be satisfied, that needs to be put to work. There has been a long-term alienation of public services from private impulse that's been going on.
Is there any chance that that Sleeping Demon would be made into a movie?
I suppose, you know, I always take these things one thing at a time. I'm going to do it at the Atlantic Theater Company in the spring, you know, take it from there. It's a good company, and they do good work. But certainly when I did Doubt at Manhattan Theater Club in a 300-seat house, I at that point had no vision that I was going to then turn it into a film. It just became a phenomenon and, you know, moved to Broadway, and then it sort of became more and more inevitable that it would be a film. Who knows, maybe that will happen with Sleeping Demon.
When is it going to be, when can we see it?
It'll be at the Atlantic Theater Company in April in New York City.
Okay, in April in New York City.
Yes.
Okay, I have to see this.
Yeah.
So what's next in terms of your writing?
Oh, I'm writing a movie for Stanley Tucci to direct and be in. Called Where's Chang for Fox Searchlight, and I'm going around the country giving a few speeches on similar topics to the ones that we've just spoken about. I just came from Waco, Texas, where I spoke at Baylor University and spoke to a very conservative population, which I'm very interested in doing, because again, I feel there's an alienation between which is inorganic between various parts of the United States, and we need to be talking to each other.
It's amazing if you look at just from a financial standpoint. Real change comes not when you change who's the president. Real change comes when we change how we individually do things. And
yes.
Yet, to me, we've been stuck, you know, trying to affect change at the macro level, because it's like we're frozen, scared to look at what's going on in our intimate space. And that's why I'm so encouraged at the response you're getting, because that's what you're doing. You're the artists always have to go first. But you're taking us into our intimate space, and somehow it's not as overwhelming to look at the ridiculousness of what we're personally doing.
Well, I'm glad that you think so. I mean, it's the artist's job is to describe what isn't there and should be. So in a way, you know, I read the newspaper to see what isn't in it, and then write a play to fill that blank page.
Okay, well, John Patrick Schilling, we're very grateful for your taking the time. We're very grateful for this play. And if we can't get to New York in April, will it ever be published?
Oh, sure. And it'll be done other places.
Okay, well, that would be wonderful. That would really be wonderful. I'm also hoping for a movie. It was a pleasure speaking with you. And we wish you Godspeed.
Thank you very much. The same to you.